You're listening to On Air with JT. My name is Justin Thomas, and I have a very special interview today. Actor, producer, director, Peter Billingsley. How are you doing today, Peter?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Justin. You?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Such great timing. I mean, obviously my favorite Christmas movie, and we're only a few days away from Christmas, and what way?
I know, and it's the 40th anniversary, right?
40 years. I mean, how does that make you feel? Like, you were 10 years old, right? When you
I was 11, and then I turned 12 while we were shooting. I mean, it's wild to think about, because this was a movie that really nobody wanted to make, and took the filmmakers about 12 years to get it funded.
Wow.
They got very little money. They were the only ones who really saw the vision for this movie. And, you know, when it first came out, it didn't do very well. It did okay at the theater, and this was in 83, so films had a real limited life. And, you know, this was obviously before streaming, and video was a brand new thing, and cable was not as mainstream. So it really kind of built a cult following with, I had learned, people sharing the VHS tape with each other and passing it around. As VHS became more and more of a thing, and then it just kept growing and growing and growing. So it's been cool to see. I think in some ways it's probably better than if it was an overnight success and drastically changed your life in a day.
Yeah.
You know, it's really something that grew, because I think it found its fan base, and it grew because it was a good movie, not because it was kind of a flashy hit at the time.
Yeah, it was an excellent movie. And I was doing some research, Peter. I seen that you, before A Christmas Story, you did well over 100 commercials, and you said after like 100, I couldn't even, you know, keep count. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. Wow. A lot of them were regionals and locals. You know, this was time in the 1970s when you would do, I started doing commercials in New York City when I was a kid, not because I came from a family of acting, but more just sort of as a fun thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's a very different business back then, before social media and kind of kids branding and businesses. You know, I wasn't looked at to be an earner for my family. It was something kind of fun to do, but for whatever reason, I guess I sort of had a knack for it, and I would start booking a lot of them. So you would just, you know, we'd spend a lot of time on these. Again, a lot might be local New York commercials, or the sort of regionals in the Northeast. But that started my career, and then I started doing a couple of movies, television episodes that kind of grew into that prior to Christmas Story. So by the time I hit that set, I had been working on sets for many, many years.
Wow. So you definitely had that, you know, some experience, you know, going into that film. So you weren't, you know, I'm sure you were a little bit nervous, you know, filming that at, you know, 10, 11 years old, but going in, you had so much experience. I'm sure you felt a little
more confident. I think that's right, for sure, because I think generally, you know, nervousness can come from if you're not prepared for something.
Correct.
You know, a lot of anxiety comes from not feeling ready or prepared.
Correct.
So I had done it, and also it was a very different movie. I had never seen the preparedness of a filmmaker. I think because it took them 12 years, they were living and breathing the movie during that time to try to find a home for it. So Bob Clark, the director, had these note cards for every shot and every scene of where he had kind of, you know, things adjust a little bit, but he had really planned out camera height, lens, framing, production design, the attention to detail. I mean, I've seen that movie a lot because I researched it a lot for the sequel that we did last year, and I still notice new things in it, like every time.
Yeah, and I actually...
Just the amount of detail in it is incredible.
I know. And I actually just seen the sequel the other day, and it's actually a really good movie.
Yeah, thanks. We didn't want to mess that up and ruin the first one for people, for sure.
Yeah.
So we worked hard. There's a lot of detail in that one as well. And it was, you know, never intended to be better than the first one, because you'd never set your bar there. But we really wanted to do something that fit in nicely with it, almost kind of like a puzzle piece that can kind of connect to it.
Definitely. So, Peter, a lot of people are tuning in to your podcast, A Cinematic Christmas Journey with comedian Steve Byrne. I love the podcast.
Yeah.
I love just the whole aspect of it, of, you know, having other people in the industry talking about, you know, projects that they worked on, and just having really good in-depth conversations, and very insightful as well. I just want to ask you, like, what kind of, was there a different approach that you kind of had to come with podcasting, coming from being an actor, producer, a director, writer? Like, how was that transition? Was it kind of like a smooth transition, or was it a little bit of a learning process to a certain degree?
Yeah, well, I think both, you know, having been in front of the camera for the majority of my life, that part is kind of taken off the table. You know, you're not afraid of a microphone. And in this case, we partnered with Spotify and we have a video component to it, which is great because we have a lot of clips and we actually show the guests. I think to me, everything forms around structure.
Definitely.
And so it was figuring out the structure of the show. And really, it's an original idea of Vince Vaughn's, who's been my best friend and working partner for the last 30 years. And he's like, you know, hey, we've done a lot of Christmas movies. Me in particular, I think I've done 5. Like, you should kind of break them down. It's like, yeah, I guess I do know a little bit about movies and in particular Christmas movies.
Uh-huh.
But the cool thing was we kind of used the movie as the spine. So we really set up, kind of just quickly established, those are movies people have seen, but it's fun to just kind of contextualize what's the setup and then really try to identify what the central question of the movie is.
Definitely.
And we ask that. And then through the episode, we learn about filmmaking. We learn about how they're trying to get to that theme. And I've enjoyed it because I enjoy fan shows on movies.
Mm-hmm.
But as a filmmaker, I can give a lot of insight in terms of areas that I've tackled doing the same kind of thing, give other examples of when we faced similar challenges and give some context for the audience for it. And then, you know, it kind of builds through and then we answer that central question and see how the movie answers that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we discuss the resolve of the film. So it kind of gives the show what's needed, sort of a structural spine.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's hard to do anything without any sense of structure, because once you know the framework, then you can kind of play within that. And so I think having that established up front was better than just, you know, what are we going to do, just blabber on for 2 hours about a movie? You kind of want to be able to plot it out. And so I put a lot of research in on the front end, try to learn things, try to decode things, and, you know, pull out of the filmmakers. And, you know, as a podcaster yourself, the format being longer form is nice. Because we can get used to us doing some stuff yesterday and, you know, it was on a national show and it was like 6 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's great, but you only have 6 minutes to kind of tell 3 or 4 stories about a whole bunch of things that they want to touch on. So the longer format, you get things revealed from the filmmakers that they didn't even really think about. Because suddenly they're in a much more relaxed environment. You're going slowly. Their mind starts going back to the set and you get some really cool nuggets.
Definitely. Peter, I have to ask you, so you and Jon Favreau have collaborated on several projects from, I believe, what, Made, Elf, Iron Man. What do you think makes the collaboration in the, you know, from previous works and films that you guys have worked together on, what brings that chemistry together? Is there like a key component that really helps both of you collaborate to make something really successful?
I think so. I mean, you know, John has obviously gone on to make some very successful and very massive films that, you know, have a lot of computer effects now.
Mm.
And I think he's kind of changed, you know, those films can take a couple of years and have sort of a different style. And I think he's had a lot of success in that area. I had met Vince originally, as I shared, and then they met Vince and John on Rudy. Which Vince was in as well, and as an actor with John. And then that was, I think, in 94. They did Swingers in 96. So I had known John for a while, and I think the first thing that we collaborated on was Made. And really, Vince had asked me to come on board that to help because it was a small movie.
Mm-hmm.
The way it was set up, they didn't have a lot of resources. It wasn't a huge budget, and I had transitioned behind the scenes and was kind of grinding away, and he had seen me just sort of working on all kinds of things around the clock. And I think being friends, just knew I was a hard worker and I spent a lot of time on set. So it was early in my producing career and he brought me on, and then the relationship evolved with John after that. And I think John just thought it brought value. And so then we went into Dinner for Five together. and worked on that. And then we did some movie, which was really fun. And that was an idea that John had had about just kind of having, it was, I refer to it as almost like the original podcast, because it was kind of freeform conversation just in a group over dinner. And we really went into a restaurant and had dinner and filmed. And the guests were like, this is crazy. Now people are used to that. You know, they're like, should I be plugging anything? It's like, no, just hang out and talk. Just
talk. Just hang out.
Yeah. Other guests will ask you questions. Someone else might be a fan of yours. You can bring something up. Like, there's no, there was no pre-interview. There was no talking points or agenda. It was just really a dinner conversation. I think that's what made it special.
Yeah.
And then that grew into other things, you know, with John. But, you know, a lot of that stuff, I think, sort of boils down to trust, you know.
Definitely.
You have somebody who you trust. And I think knowing that you can get someone's back and, you know, we've all heard stories of, I think in any business, you know, there can be people who are out for different things other than themselves. And if I'm doing a project, for me, I put the movie first or the TV show first, you know, all roads lead to that. The rest of this stuff doesn't matter. It's like, we're here to do a job that's going to live on forever.
Yeah.
Shouldn't we try to make the best film or the best television show or the best musical that we can, because that's really what's going to matter. And so I think that's how I approach my work. And I'll take an idea from anywhere. It doesn't matter. If it's a great idea and it's going to help the project, then it's worth it. And, you know, they all take the same amount of time, whether it's a little one or a big one. They all suck the same amount of bandwidth out of your life. So why not try to make it great?
But everything does turn out great. I mean, at least from my perspective, from all the work that you've done. But going back to, you know, Elf, you know, I was watching, I mean, there's a classic clip from Howard Stern of him interviewing John. And, you know, from what John said in the interview was, you know, long story short, you know, the studios weren't really banking on Elf to be a box office hit. And, you know, Stern asked him, you know, what was the biggest takeaway from, you know, the critical acclaim success, you know, coming after Elf? And his response was basically, honestly, just being able to work in Hollywood. Did you have a feeling, or was it kind of totally unexpected of the end result and seeing what Elf ended up in is today a classic movie?
Yeah, I just read it the 20th year of it.
Yeah.
So I just had a small cameo in that.
Yeah.
But wanted to be supportive of John. He had asked me to come up and do that part. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's another, it's an interesting thing when you look at it, you know, that I remember reading that script and feeling they had something really good. Mm-hmm. But again, it's sort of in, like, Christmas Story is an odd tone, you know. Elf's a hard one to hit. And you have a guy who's kind of an insane guy in the same world, you know, and, you know, how much is too much, and it's funny and good as Will is, like, you know, what's the balance of that, and will that work? And I think that was somewhat of the fear, but it's like, you got to kind of commit to what the vision you have.
Exactly. And
go for it. You know, you can't really play a lot of defense. Mm-hmm. You got to say, look, we signed up, now we got to go. But I think it's a great, you know, it's a great story in that sense that you work hard, you try hard, you believe in what you're doing, and ultimately the audience is going to get to make the choice, right?
Exactly.
And the audience decides. There's a lot of experts along the way that are paid to help sort of decide what goes, what doesn't go, and they all have opinions, but ultimately you get your damn court. And, you know, the audience gets to make a decision if they like it or not, and if they do, they're going to watch it.
Definitely.
And if they're watching it, then the studio is going to lean into it and play it. And so it's, you know, it's hard to navigate, because I think on all these jobs, you have a lot of voices, and you have your own voices or your own self-doubts that you're trying to overcome. There's the financiers, and then your co-collaborators and everybody. And it's, you know, the good ones are able to shut that out, I think, lock into what they want to do. I mean, Christmas Story was the same example. As I said, no one wanted, I remember ever a studio being involved or them complaining about it. I think they basically gave filmmakers their money and were just like, okay, you've been pestering us for 12 years. Leave us alone. Here's a little money. Go make your movie. And the director had to agree to direct other movies for them later in the future and threw his whole salary in to make up the budget. So it was kind of a blessing in that way, where nobody believed it. Nobody thought about it. They financed it, and that became that. I think it can be a similar thing with this. you know, sort of a long way to make my point, but that you just, they listened to their own compass. They had a vision for it. It's a weird tone, that movie. But it worked. And, you know, there's obviously examples of when people steadfast believe in something and it doesn't work, but then you get up and you do it again. You know, it's like a quarterback throwing an interception. It's like, you're still a good quarterback. Yeah. You know, you threw the wrong pass or they made a read. You made a misread. Okay, you got to let it go and you got to move on.
Yeah.
And that can be hard because it's on a public stage. And I think there's some people that are better at that. Others are doing it, but it's no different for anyone else in other forms in life. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something that you strongly believe in doing and you've really weighed it through. You beat it up yourself from a lot of different angles, and you've got to have the confidence and the courage to be able to go after that, regardless of what people are going to say. And you're never going to please everybody. That is for sure.
Yeah. You know, you definitely have to have that tunnel vision. I mean, I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, Peter, but when it comes to whether you're producing a project or directing or acting, whatever it is, it's very important and crucial to really listen to that intuition and that inner voice. And kind of, even though there's so much noise, whether it's from agents, managers, studios, etc., there's so much noise. How do you kind of block out that noise and just stay focused when sometimes films or
and
is so chaotic?
I think it's you 100% listen to that inner voice. And I think the other component that, as I've gotten older, I add to that is you also have to be honest with yourself.
Okay.
Right? Like, so here's someone who's sort of steadfast on this is how it works, and they haven't put all the thought into it, or they're not seeing the signs around them that maybe are telling them things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's still being honest with yourself. You'll see people get too close to something and then they'll ruin it because they don't have the ability to step back and to examine it. So it's, I think, a hard thing to articulate, but I think also as I've gotten older, you're probably your best compass as you've done things. And so kind of have to make something that you really like,
mm-hmm.
and then trust that other people are going to like it, particularly if you have, you know, if you've done some things before and you have good taste in an area, you know, if that kind of also becomes the compass. I know on the sequel a lot, you know, I really tried to work from that place. Like, I understand what fans and everybody like, but I also have a connection to this movie of 40 years. And
yeah.
So, you know, if I'm going to make a sequel about this, you know, and it was an extremely collaborative effort with a lot of great partners, but I felt like I didn't want to walk away from that until I felt very happy with it. And then we feel comfortable putting my pencil down, so to speak. So I think just the other component of that is in some ways being honest with yourself. We've all seen friends or colleagues get too bullheaded in a direction when there's signs that are coming at them. And so you challenging, one of the most challenging parts is when you're testing a movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, audience testing, because now you've made it in studios or even you as a filmmaker, you want to put it up in front of an audience, and then you get this feedback, some of which is very critical, some of which is gushingly great.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to interpret what to do with that data. So there's times you have to be extremely objective and look at the movie in third person and remove your personal connections to it because you're so close to it. So I think that's the art. I don't think it's only in film. I think that's in life, you know.
Yeah, you have to look
in
at
your friendships, in relationships. You do. You have to step aside and look at it. What part did I play in that?
Yep.
But I contribute to that, you know. Or, hey, I really do believe this is the right path forward, and now I have to put my convictions forward and push for this. So it is that balance, but I don't think that just listening to a bunch of outside voices to guide you is ever a good roadmap to take.
I definitely think it's crucial to look at it, like you said, from different perspectives and all vantage points, and then you can kind of decipher your own intuition and inner voice and what you think is the right move.
Yeah, and I remember I did a show with Bill Burr called F is for Family, which was
that.
A series for Netflix, which was an animated show. And we were, you know, we had a smaller budget for the first season. It was only 6 episodes. It was a little bit of a kind of, you know, Netflix was supportive, but I think also wanted to see what we were going to kind of come up with and make sure that it was good before they committed to doing more. And then we really worked hard on those first 6 episodes. And I remember it was like late at night. We had to turn in the schedule, like the final one, and it was really the end of it, and we had to turn it in and be done. And we hadn't done a ton of testing on it, other than some small group showings. But I remember Bill saying, "Hey, I'm really happy with this. I'm really happy with what we made. And no matter what happens, I'm going to be very happy because I love the quality of work that we've done and I love the show that we made." And it was like, you know, that was kind of the target for him. It was a very personal show and he wanted to put something out that he was really proud of. Now it, you know, it did begin to find an audience. We were able to do 5 seasons on that show. So, but it was just a good kind of reminder of like, you know, why are you doing it? Where's your bar? What are you aiming to hit?
I know we're kind of running out of time, Peter, but I do have a couple more questions for you.
And, sure.
And one of those questions is, one of the main questions I wanted to ask you was, so Couples Retreat, that was your directorial debut, correct?
Correct, yeah.
So did you expect for the numbers that it did in the box office, like going into that for your first film directing? Because it did
I mean,
very well.
It did extremely well, yeah. To some degree, yes. I mean, I think the pressure on those movies, and particularly at that time before streaming, right, was that those movies had to open and they had to perform.
Yeah.
Because you had a, you know, major movie star in Vince starring in it, and it was Bateman and Favreau and a lot of other great people.
Amazing cast.
It was a studio movie.
Yeah.
So the expectations are how they're going to spend into the marketing on it.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to get it right. But it was a great collaboration with Vince. You know, that was an original idea that he had. And Vince was also a writer. He was the lead producer on the movie. So, you know, it was us kind of shoulder to shoulder moving through that movie, which was great. So I think that, you know, we had a great history of doing a lot of stuff and a good friendship. So that gives you a lot of confidence moving into it.
Definitely.
But definitely, it's, you know, it's not like, whoa, this little indie really blew up. That's awesome, guys. It's different in like, it has to deliver. And it would have been really disappointing if it didn't. Do you know what I mean? And I think in some ways it exceeded it. That movie's had an interesting life. It really plays a lot on TV. I think people, it's just the nature of it. People tell me they can pick up and leave off and kind of come in and out and laugh and enjoy it. And the visuals are really nice to look at.
Oh, yeah, it's a whole
so I think,
movie.
Especially in the winter, people like turning it on and that kind of reminder of, well, there's warmer days to come soon.
Definitely. What is your favorite scene from Couples Retreat? Or is there like a specific memory that you have on set that you look back and are like, wow?
Yeah, I think shooting all the therapy stuff was hilarious. And yeah. And Vince and John Michael Higgins, who played Vince's therapist, they had done Break Up Together and some other films going into that.
Okay.
John Michael Higgins is the one guy who, Vince is an improvisational master, and improv, the true meaning of it, not where you're just writing jokes, but you're staying on story, which is very hard, but you're rewriting the lines in your head, but you're still delivering the intention of the scene. Most people just go off and start doing gags, and that's not what real improv should be or is.
Exactly.
John Michael Higgins is the only person that can make Vince break. Because Vince is so committed. If he's in the scene, no matter how funny or interesting or clever or left-turny you come at him, but John's the only one. So there is really hours of footage that is on the cutting room floor that is just the two going at each other completely in character. One is a therapist. One is a guy who doesn't want to hear this shit from somebody. And, you know, you just have to, there's only so much that you can use. And then I remember in those therapies, Vince was great because he would then, even in other people's therapy rooms, he would be like shouting jokes at them, right, to do.
Yeah.
And so like in Faison's room or in Kristen and John's room, and they do them and they're hilarious, but it's just, you only have so much time. And there were some great rants. Maybe some of it wound up on the DVD, which was fun because back then there was sort of a place for it. But
it was so funny. I was actually just watching one of the videos on Facebook, one of the gag reels, and there was the scene with Kristen at the dinner table, and she was like laughing, and I believe it was your voice in the background. It just looked like everybody was having a really good time.
It was fun. It was a fun set to explore and to try that stuff. That's what you want to do, and you know. In the podcast, we did Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and we had the editor, Paul Hirsch, on.
Okay.
Paul won the Oscar for Star Wars as an editor. It's Cutting Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. He said the first cut of that movie, the director's cut that he assembled to screen, which is always a little long. Mm. Okay, maybe it's 2 hours, 2 hours and 20 minutes, 2.5, was 3 hours and 45 minutes.
Wow.
The movie's ultimately 90 minutes. And that's what he just cut into the movie. To just cut the scenes. He said John Hughes shot so much footage. They shot, 80 days? I mean, a normal comedy would be 40 days of shooting. So John had the same process where he would try things. And then ultimately, you know, you sift through in the edit room, it makes the edit journey really challenging. Mm-hmm. But when you have great comedians on set, you have a point of view, you have an environment that you're in, it's sometimes hard not to do that. And so that set, I think, was very filled with a lot of that. And a lot of great stuff came from that. That's in the movie. A lot of stuff returns back to the script because the script is still, is your guidepost. You know, it's still your map.
Definitely.
That leads you to where you want to go. But within there, you can kind of color within the lines. You just don't go outside the lines, you know, but being able to color within those lines is fun. And Vince is really great at that and setting a tone on set for that. And being very unselfish and giving other people jokes and moments and coming up with things. And, you know, that was, that movie we shot on film, but we ran a lot to take long.
About your favorite memory of Couples Retreat, it's only right that I ask you, what is your favorite scene or memory from A Christmas Story? I mean, for me personally, I always laugh at the leg lamp scene. I mean, it always gets me.
Yeah, that was fun. I Bob Clark would do a lot of stuff where the movie was heavily scripted, so we didn't improv dialogue.
Okay.
But he would do a lot of things where he would surprise you on set, like not show you certain things until the cameras were rolling.
Oh.
And I think the leg lamp was one of those where, like, he wanted to see our discovery of it in frame because it's such an odd thing.
Yeah,
you know, like that kid who comes up to me in Higby's and is like, "I like the Tin Man." He just told that kid to start doing that to me. So, as bothered as I look in that scene, is because I was extremely bothered. Now I can't break the tape because this kid's talking to me. But you know, he would do great stuff like that. I think to get very real moments out of you, and so that's probably my most fun memory. And I think that's fun when you're a little surprised because things can get stale.
Yeah.
You know, you have to do a scene from multiple angles, multiple takes each. By the end of the day, it's like really hard to keep it fresh.
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard for the actors. The crew's heard the joke now 40 times. They're not laughing anymore. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to go home. But yet you still have to keep it like it's the first time doing it.
Yeah.
So Bob would do a great job of capturing that early. So he had those angles captured. And then we would go in and kind of get the other stuff. And it's a very cool way to work.
Yeah, that's actually really brilliant. I really did not know that.
It is, and I think especially with kids, because you're going to get that
naivety,
really genuine surprise. You know, a trained actor is maybe better at conditioning themselves to give you that surprised look over and over and over.
Uh-huh.
But it's a little more challenging for a kid maybe with less skill. So I think he did that with the kids a lot, and I think it really helped the performances.
Yeah, it most certainly did. Now, Peter, so how long is basically A Cinematic Christmas Journey? Is this podcast going into next year, or is this just for this year?
It will, yeah. So we did 6 Christmas movies last year. We came on the second season this year, and we're going to start to expand into other movies.
Awesome.
So A Cinematic Journey. We'll have A Cinematic Adventure Journey, which will come out. We did Back to the Future and City Slickers and Raiders of the Lost Ark, some really cool adventure movies, and kind of get in and break those down. And, you know, I only like to do movies that I love. And so I think there's, you know, a lot of movies and a lot of different genres, and we're extremely excited. Christmas felt like a logical starting point for me, obviously.
Yeah,
but,
makes sense.
Having a chance to get into the other movies, exactly.
Yeah.
Will be very, very cool.
Definitely. And I was going to ask you, do you, for the most part, like hand select or like reach out to people that you want to have on the episodes in the podcast?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, sometimes we have actors, but sometimes it's fun to have a filmmaker, to have a cinematographer.
I agree.
To have the editor of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was cool because we had learned a little bit of, you know, that is an editing masterpiece. That's a masterclass. Paul Hirschfeld, still to this day, he's never had, and he went on to do so many movies, including Ray and Best Picture winning movies, all kinds of things. Mm. He'd never seen a director's cut that long in his entire career since.
Wow.
And that was a long time ago, that movie. So, you know, that was the theme of that one, was how do you, you know, it's really a masterclass in editing. And he really breaks down kind of what that process and when it's overwhelming and what you do. And they had to test that movie 4 days a week, and they had to completely rewrite the ending in post with a looming deadline of having to be in theaters because the movie was not testing. So it's cool when you learn these movies that went through those challenges. They really all do have a life of their own. And as much as fans, and we look at them and we're like, wow, these guys, they really nailed that. Yeah. Like, yeah, there was so much that went into getting to that final product.
Yeah,
definitely. And it really makes you appreciate them a lot more. And I think, you know, the fun thing with Christmas movies too, especially now, is there's a reason why they come back on the lists every year, mm-hmm. because there's a magic to them and that timeless feeling and meaning of Christmas and forgiveness and hope and love and joy, you know, that come from these movies. Is a really nice thing. So it's been very gratifying to be able to share that.
Have you been missing a little bit of being in film and television and writing, producing, or is most of your attention and energy just going right into the show?
Yeah, I mean, it moves around. We had a 6-month shutdown from the strike this year.
Yeah.
You know, so that was obviously a challenging time, but and worked hard on the sequel last year, which was great to have that come out. And, you know, was able to dive in a little more to some podcasting this year. And then we'll get back to work next year on some new stuff.
That's awesome. And so everybody can follow you on Instagram, which is Official Peter B, right?
That is correct. Yes, I'm somewhat new to it, but I've been liking it a lot. It's been nice to share a lot of clips from the show as well.
And everybody that's listening, definitely check out the podcast, A Cinematic Christmas Journey. It's available on Spotify. Peter, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. It really means a lot.
Thank you very much. This was a lot of fun, and you did a very nice job. I've done a lot of these, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Appreciate it.
JT here. I got to let you guys know about this really cool giveaway that I'm doing. Myself and Pure Hemp Paper has partnered up, and we're doing a really cool giveaway for my fans and my listeners and followers. So for all my smokers out there that like to smoke paper, well, this could be yours, and you don't have to pay a penny. So how do you win? I'll let you know. And the description will be also down below. So by the time that you're seeing this, you'll have 2 weeks to keep entering this giveaway and contest every single day. And all you need to do is follow my page, On Air with JT, and most importantly, Pure Hemp Paper on Instagram. And then you have to like this video, share it on your Instagram stories, and tag myself and Pure Hemp Paper so we both know that you have officially entered the contest, so we can mark you guys down. And in 2 weeks, one lucky person's gonna win all this fucking paper.
And you gonna get high.
If you are interested in advertising or sponsorships, please send all business inquiries to onairwithjt@gmail.com. Listen to On Air with JT on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and can be seen on YouTube. onairwithjt.com.
JT did it again.
JT here. Pure Hemp Rolling Papers was launched in 1996 from the desire to have a tree-free alternative rolling paper. They are made from pesticide-free, chemical-free. Pure Hemp's manufacturers have been around for quite some time. The Miguel family has been perfecting paper making since 1725. That's almost 300 years of paper making experience. Pure Hemp Rolling Papers is an eco-conscious alternative to all the wood pulp rice rolling papers on the market. They are focused on offering a tree-free rolling paper complemented with an all-natural vegan gum line that is sustainably sourced from West African trees. Pure Hemp created rolling papers to be as pure as possible. 25 plus years later, and Pure Hemp family has grown substantially. They've expanded into pre-roll cones, spiral wraps, and individualized pre-roll cones. Reach out to Pure Hemp and discover their superior Pure Hemp pre-roll cones. At Pure Hemp, they are always listening, learning, adapting, and constantly innovating. When I smoke paper, I smoke the Pure Hemp way. Go check them out on Instagram at Pure Hemp Paper and give them a follow. Tell them JT sent you.
JT did it again.